From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. A concert on this edition of Fresh Air with the man who's been called the hardest swinging jazz pianist of all time, Dave McKenna. Also today we meet Dutch actor Jeroen Krabbé. He's one of his country's premier actors. Now he's making a name in this country in such films as The Living Daylights, Crossing Delancey, and Scandal. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Will the Circle Be Unbroken Volume 2 by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And guest film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Today we have a live concert with the jazz pianist that many agree is the best there is when it comes to interpreting songs, Dave McKenna. Jazz critic Dan Morgenstern writes that McKenna's singular artistry covers the whole vocabulary of piano, from stride to bop. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot called Dave McKenna the hardest swinging jazz pianist of all time. But Balliot pointed out this paradox, quote, McKenna plays the piano with supreme authority, but considers himself a barroom pianist, unquote. For the past 9 years, McKenna has performed nightly at an elegantly appointed bar in Boston's Copley Plaza Hotel. Summers he performs on Cape Cod. He has close to a dozen recent solo and small group albums on the Concord Jazz record label, and CBS Records just reissued a session of his from the late 1950s. If you're a regular listener to Fresh Air, you've heard excerpts from many of McKenna's records between segments on our show. And I have to tell you that this is a concert we've been hoping to present for a long time. Dave McKenna, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a complete pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Terry.
And I'd like to ask you to introduce the first song you'd like to play.
Okay, this is a tune by Dietzen Schwartz called By Myself.
That's beautiful. You know, I especially like hearing you perform solo. And I think the reason is that your sense of rhythm is so strong. It's like you're accompanying yourself. And I just assume not hear anybody with you so I can hear completely what it is you're doing, and I was wondering if you especially like playing solo.
Well, of course, it's the way I make my living now. But it's fun to play with a band. I don't... the bass-piano duo thing or the piano-trio thing doesn't work with me because it's that in-between thing. I don't think I ever got that down. But I really love playing with bass and drums and a horn or two, you know, trumpet and saxophone and a guitar, too. I love that. But I play it a different way then, and it's just, it really is fun. But anything less than four pieces, I'd rather be alone, I think, because I can, it's great working with good bass players, and there are plenty of them now, and drummers, but this way I can change tempo. I'd have to work with a bass player for years and just change tunes, you know, and when you play solo, a lot of it is just killing time, killing the clock.
You think so?
Yeah.
Oh, one more question before we get to the next song. That was just called By Myself, what you just played. And I think of you as having gone by yourself in a way of being a bit of a loner, playing, you know, for long stays in a supper club or in a hotel and having lots of people come to you, and you have a home base, which is something very few people in jazz have the luxury of.
Yeah, I've really been lucky that way. I avoided a lot of traveling, although I like to do a certain amount. I still get on the road some. And maybe we'll get on the road considerably more soon. I don't know.
Would you play another song for us?
Sure.
Was Yours Is My Heart Alone, performed live by pianist Dave McKenna. When you're playing a song, do you usually know the lyrics to it?
Well, I didn't used to know. I don't think I know the words to one song all the way through. But You know, I do like to listen to singers, and bits and pieces of the words come back to me. And it's nice when you know a few. I think it
does
really
it help
makes
with
you,
the interpretation?
I think so. I think it helps play, helps you to play the melody better.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember a few of the words now. Never used to.
Do you like to learn a song from just hearing it or from sheet music?
I'm such a, let me say, I won't say it. Yeah, I'm a bad sight reader. I just rather hear it, yeah, from somebody. That the trouble is now that, to hear a song, I don't learn many new songs, to tell you the truth, because there are a lot of good rock songs and there are a few top 40 things, but they need guitars or singers or something. There aren't many tunes that really sound good on the piano that are being written now. But I suppose there are a few, and once in a while, somebody asks me to learn something, so I get the sheet music. But even then, I'd rather hear somebody play it or sing it before I play it.
I'm going to ask you to play another song. You want to do Sweet Lorraine?
Yeah.
Performed for us live by Dave McKenna. You know, I want to ask you, I know that for the past 9 years or so, you've been at the Copley in a very elegant bar there. A lot of times when people go into a bar, they're pleased that there's music, but they don't necessarily know the first thing about music or the first thing about their hearing, about what they're hearing, and they might talk while the musician is playing. How does that affect you when people are talking and you're playing?
That's cool. It's such a comfortable situation. The Copley Most people who come into Rome aren't coming in to hear me, because a lot of them are convention people or from the hotel. And they're just in for a drink at nice surroundings. And so it's not a concert, and I don't expect in many cases, it's easier playing. Because I can, you know, I just play lightly and fiddle around and play. If you think of what I'm going to play next, there's no pressure. I could play quietly a good part of the night. And I usually come up a little bit in volume at the end of a set to let them know I'm there, that I've been working. And some nights people listen, and a lot of times they don't. But essentially, it's a background music gig, really. And, hey, I had 9 years or so, and I like staying in Boston. It was a nice stay at the hotel. It's walking distance from about anything in town, including the ballpark, and everything's handy in that city. You know,
I saw you perform once at a club in Cape Cod, and the room was filled. You were staring off into space, not intentionally, I thought, not making eye contact with anybody. You know, just focused on nothing in particular, but obviously very, very focused, but really avoiding people's
eyes.
Was
that the Capitol and L House?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a fun. That's a nice place, and for years, the family, great friends of mine, they're wonderful people, the Lumens that ran it. But that gig, people did listen a lot there.
Oh, yeah, no, it was.
And it was like
quiet.
A concert. And,
but
I
it
mean,
seemed to
times,
me you just didn't want to see anybody.
Some nights were noisy. Well, yeah, when
you're
playing in those circumstances and everybody's listening, how they say, I'm saying to myself, oh, gee, how am I going to fill up an hour if these people are listening intently? So when I'm looking off into space, I'm thinking of medleys to play, things that'll wind the clock down, you know? I really am.
Well, I don't fully understand. Yeah,
getting things together to play. You know?
Uh-huh. It amazes me that you're worried about people listening intently.
Well, no, I'm not worried about it. If they want to, I'll play. But you have to work harder then.
Right, I see. Okay. All right. Well, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue the concert. My guest is one of the very great jazz pianists, Dave McKenna, who's based in Boston and Cape Cod and is joining us for a live concert today. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Get back to the concert. Let's see. I think next you're going to play Sea Jam Blues.
Thank you.
Oh, great. Do you plan out what you're going to play at all before you play it? Plan out, I mean the improvisation, but just the tempo you're going to play at, what your basic concept for a song or a piece is going to be?
Well, really kind of vaguely, because I didn't really know what tempo I was going to play that. But that change of key, I did that on record, changing the keys, because I thought maybe a feeble attempt to be clever. If it's C Jan, it means the key. And so I changed it to E flat for one 12-bar chorus and one to G flat or F sharp, whatever that is, and one in A, up in minor thirds, and ending back in C. So that was a little game. So I do use that whenever I play that, a little change of key at the end.
You know, sitting right next to you at the piano, I'm really watching your hands carefully, and you have such a strong left hand when I hear your records. And your left hand is almost gently approaching the keyboard. I mean, you don't seem to be exerting yourself with your left hand at all.
When I try to play a stride, I do. I try to work hard. I'm not really adept. I can play, if I play it with some strength, then it gets kind of sloppy. I came to stride piano late. I only use it for a few bars at a time, but that's real work. I stand in awe of those guys that play it all the time, you know. Ralph Sutton, Dick Wellstone.
Yeah.
They really play it hard and accurately, you know. And
is accurate hard when you're playing stride?
Yeah, I think so. Because they've been playing it a long time. You know, some guys made a specialty of it, and their whole career was based on that. You know, the older guys, Fats and James P., those are the guys that invented it, I guess. But as far as the walking bass, that sort of just playing bass notes, that just seemed to come naturally to me, and it's not much exertion required there.
Were you self-taught, or was there a pianist who
studied
carefully with?
I had lessons from my first teachers were the nuns and parochials. My mother's a real good musician, though. She played piano and violin, but she didn't want to teach, so she sent me the nuns. And I didn't really like to practice, but I could always pick tunes out that I heard on the radio and always played by ear, it seems, since I was about 7 years old. So I had a couple of good teachers, a guy in Boston, Sandy Sandiford, who was a jazz musician of sorts. I mean, he was a good jazz player, but he made his living writing showbiz charts for the singers around Boston. But he didn't, I was 16 or so by the time I went to him, and he didn't really fool with the way I played. He just made a few suggestions into how to organize it, and he said, why don't you make a little arrangement of this? And the lessons were kind of spotty because I was still living in my parents' house, and I didn't get up there often. But he had some nice suggestions anyway.
We're going to have time for one more song, and can I make a request?
Yeah.
Would you play Thanks for the Memory?
Of course.
was great. Do you have a good musical memory? Do you know lots and lots and lots of songs?
I think I knew quite a few. I'm not one of the champions, though. Guys like Jimmy Rolls, I don't know how many, Men of a Thousand Tunes. But I knew quite a few, and it doesn't seem, though, as if I've been adding to the repertoire lately. I don't learn too many new songs. But a lot of the tunes I've been playing, I think I've known since I was 12 years old. That's not one of them, though. I never realized I liked the tune until, I don't know, I heard somebody do it, and that's when I came upon fairly late. Although I'd heard of it, you know, being a Bob Hope theme and all.
Well, I want to thank you so very much for joining us for this concert. It's really been a pleasure to have you here. And I want to say you've helped me hear a lot of songs in fresh ways through your interpretations of them. So thank you. Thank you very much for all your playing and for doing the concert today.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Dave McKenna has many records on Concord Jazz. His latest is No More Uzo for Puzo. On June 24th, after more than 9 years, he'll end his engagement at the Copley Plaza Hotel in Boston. And he'll do some touring so audiences around the country will have a chance to see him perform. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Philip Lopate. His new book, Against Joie de Vivre, includes personal essays on topics such as New Age weddings, his distaste for joie de vivre, and a personal essay on the personal essay itself. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jeroen Krabbe is a well-known Dutch actor, but every time Hollywood gave him a call, it was to play another foreign bad guy. That might be changing. Coming up, Jeroen Krabbe talks about his recent roles in Crossing Delancey and Scandal. Also, guest film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the new Indiana Jones movie. And 18 years ago, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band made an album that brought together performers from around the rock and country worlds. Now they've tried it again. Ken Tucker reviews Will the Circle Be Unbroken, Volume 2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. In Beijing, the Chinese Politburo has reportedly taken the first step toward ousting Communist Party chief Zhao Ziyang. Zhao and other moderate Chinese leaders have been accused of forming an anti-party clique. A formal announcement has not been made, but sources say the Politburo is meeting to bring an end to the power struggle that has erupted over handling of the latest pro-democracy demonstrations in Beijing. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev was elected president of the Soviet government as the first day of the Congress of the People's Deputies ended in Moscow. Gorbachev has headed the Communist Party since 1985, and the presidential post he now holds was redefined in the Constitution last fall to broaden its powers. As Lisa Dobbs reports, Gorbachev's nomination and election followed an unprecedented amount of criticism.
Gorbachev did have an opponent, 45-year-old Alexander Oblinsky, an engineer from Leningrad. But the 2,250 deputies overwhelmingly voted against even registering Oblinsky's name on the ballot, and Gorbachev won 95.6% of the deputies' votes. During today's short speeches, many of the deputies criticized Gorbachev on his record, and many wanted him to address himself to the economic crisis. Others demanded that he say whether he was in favor of sending in troops to break up local demonstrations. Still, there was an enormous amount of praise lavished on Gorbachev by the deputies, and just before the final vote, Gorbachev, who sat through the speeches today, answered some of the criticism. He said perestroika was a difficult process and that the Soviet Union is in one of its most trying stages. He also said he wasn't aware of the order to send troops to the Georgian capital of Tbilisi until the following morning. For National Public Radio, this is Lisa Dobbs in Moscow.
The formal announcement won't come until later this evening, but congressional sources say the United States is citing Japan, Brazil, and India for unfair trade practices in a long-awaited report on America's trading partners. The government reportedly cites the unfair trade practices of Brazil for licensing and services, India for investment, and Japan for wood products, satellites, and supercomputers. The list of countries is required under the so-called Super 301 provision of the 1988 Trade Act. Countries on the list have 18 months to negotiate fair trade agreements with the U.S. or face possible retaliation. The Nicaraguan government has expelled two American diplomats on charges of inciting political disturbances. It's the second time in less than a year that U.S. diplomats have been thrown out of the country. David Golub has details.
Joel Franklin Kassman and Kathleen Williamson Barnon have only been in Nicaragua for a few days. Kassman is the new economic attaché at the American Embassy in Managua. He replaces the economic officer who was expelled along with the U.S. ambassador and six other American diplomats in July last year. Barnon is head of labor affairs for Central America and is attached to the U.S. Embassy in Honduras. Kassman and Barnon were photographed together at a teachers' demonstration in a provincial town yesterday. Teachers in several towns have been staging labor stoppages this week to press demands for pay increases. Nicaraguan teachers earn less than $20 a month, but the government says it can't afford to raise pay, and it has accused the American diplomats of inciting the protests. The acting U.S. ambassador says the allegations are without foundation. For National Public Radio, I'm David Golub in Managua.
In San Bernardino, California, an underground gasoline pipeline today exploded into massive flames. Two people were killed, at least two dozen injured. As many as 11 homes have been destroyed by flames. The explosion occurred at a 14-inch Calnev pipeline. The cause was not immediately known. 2 weeks ago, a train derailed in the same neighborhood, killing four people and wrecking a number of homes. Stock prices were lower today in mixed trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell just over a point to close at 2482.59. Volume was 154 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. About 6 months ago, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band got together with several dozen country and rock musicians in a studio in Tennessee, and over the next few weeks recorded an album, Will the Circle Be Unbroken, Volume 2. It features performances by some veterans of the first Circle album, Johnny Cash, the Carter Family, and Earl and Randy Scruggs, along with some new recruits like Roseanne Cash, Roger McGuinn, and Bruce Hornsby. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Trouble singing about that sweet old by and by.
If I was a mean old rock critic, I'd point out that the last time most of us thought much about the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band was 18 years ago, when the first Will the Circle Be Unbroken collection was released. In other words, when they're not surrounded by superstars, this is a rather tepid little outfit whose Long Beach, California roots are closer to folk and pop than the old-fashioned country music they admire. But let's give the Dirt Band its due. When that first circle collection came out in 1972, it arrived as a gesture of reconciliation. Country and rock musicians were eyeing each other very warily in those days, and so when the Dirt Band hatched their idea, it was a pleasant surprise when the likes of Roy Acuff, Mother Maybelle Carter, and Earl Scruggs agreed to collaborate. Not for nothing was that album subtitled Music Forms a New Circle. Well, the circumference of that circle has been expanding over the last decade and a half. By now, the country rock synthesis is taken for granted, which makes Will the Circle Be Unbroken Volume 2 something less than the cultural event the first one was. This time around, it's as if they recorded anyone who walked in the door. How else to explain the presence of John Denver?
You can drive around in a long limousine. If you don't know where you're going, it don't mean a thing. He who'd walk a mile just to hold an empty hand knows what it means. A wealthy man, ashes to ashes, dust into dust, palaces will crumble, bridges will rust, mountains will disappear.
The 20 songs on Circle Volume 2 are wildly uneven, as might be expected from a collection that includes so many different styles. After a couple of painfully sincere numbers by Emmylou Harris, for example, it comes as an immense relief to get a blast of energy from a former member of Bill Monroe's Bluegrass Boys, Jimmy Martin.
Now she's gone and I don't worry. Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world. Sunny day, my good gal left me, she went away. Now she's gone and I don't worry, Lord, I'm a-setting on top of the world. She called me from Dallas in El Paso, said come back daddy, I need you so. Now she's gone and I don't worry, Lord, I'm a-setting on top of the world.
Jimmy Martin's pinched nasal singing and gratifyingly direct phrasing puts most of the whippersnappers on this collection to shame. His performance is matched in quality only a few times, and most convincingly by John Hiatt and Roseanne Cash, who sing a lovely version of Hiatt's song, One Step Over the Line.
I know it's just your daddy's car. Your daddy never went this far. Baby, we know who we are. Let's go. One step over the line, I could be your driving wheel. We could make those tires squeal. Ooh, I like the way it feels. Taking it one step over the line.
One step forward and two steps back. It's for the birds now, baby. I'm talking cake, walking into the black, crossing red.
One of the disappointments of Circle Volume 2 is that there isn't much interaction between the generations. The Dirt Band backs up just about everyone, but we never hear what it might sound like if, say, Jimmy Martin and Roseanne Cash were to harmonize, or if Johnny Cash was to add his nitty-gritty voice to Emmylou Harris's. Instead, we get an aimless assortment that yields the occasional pleasure, such as Levon Helm of the band yearning for the grave on When I Get My Rewards.
Oh, the night is so still. Not a baby will cry. Not a chill wind will blow. Disturbing the sky. But there's no peace in me. I'm burning for you. I'm walking the floor in the devil's shoes. When I get my rewards, I will bring them to you.
The only time everyone gets together is on the title song. That's when, finally, a lot of the self-consciousness that characterizes this project is thrown off and everyone sings out clearly.
Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Jeroen Krabbe is one of Holland's leading stage and film actors. He starred in Paul Verhoeven's hit films Soldier of Orange and The Fourth Man. Krabbe is known to international audiences for his leading role as a Soviet general in the 1987 James Bond film The Living Daylights. And Americans will recognize him as the egotistical émigré writer who seduces Amy Irving in the film Crossing Delancey. In the new film Scandal about the Profumo affair, Krabbe is again cast as a Russian. He plays Captain Eugene Ivanov, a diplomat who's involved with Christine Keeler while she's also having an affair with John Profumo, the British Minister of War. In this scene, Krabbe, as the Soviet diplomat, is driving Keeler home from a party.
You know what I see when I look at this country? Doom, decay, a land without honor.
Not that bad.
You saw this Profumo, you saw what he did. He was walking on the bottom at the shallow end. What kind of man is this?
You're just angry because he beat you.
He cheated. He was walking on the bottom. He's a cabinet minister and he cheats at games.
Now, you play a Russian in Scandal.
Yeah.
Have you found that in some English-speaking movies that when you're not, when you're from a country other than America or England, that you can be cast as a foreigner from any number of countries?
Yeah, that's true. Because, for instance, for Crossing the Land Sea, my character started off as a Yugoslavian, then I was a Greek, then it turned to an Italian, then a French guy, and finally we ended up me playing a Dutch guy, which I am. So that was quite nearby. But they, you know, especially in America, they could cast you for so many things because they think people from Europe, they're all the same, which is not true, of course, but they cast you for a Scandinavian or an Italian or, you know, that sort of thing. But it broadens the whole thing for me. I mean, it's the whole field is quite wide, the spectrum for which they ask me. So it's an advantage.
Now, the role you played in Crossing Delancey.
Yeah.
Was of an émigré literary star who's very narcissistic, very sexist.
Yeah. Has nothing to do with me.
Yeah, I'm sure. And this character always likes to have a woman around who's going to be the private secretary and
right,
the lover
right.
And cater to his every wish.
Didn't you like him?
Oh, well.
He was kind of a jerk, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. But it was a great portrayal, I thought. I mean, I recognized the character right away.
Yeah, that's what all the women say.
Well, I was wondering if you had a person in mind to pattern it on. I mean, I'm
not asking you to name names.
Many
friends of mine, yeah, absolutely. No, I don't mention any names, but I know those guys. I'm not like that at all. In a way, I'm quite dull. I'm married for 23 years. I have 3 kids. I'm a cook. I cook at home. I do some ironing and cleaning, yeah, that sort of thing. So I'm quite a dull guy, and I'm not at all that guy that I portrayed in Crossing the Lands. But I know a couple of macho guys, despicable macho guys, and I portrayed this character after them.
You should thank me.
What for?
For not calling you in the middle of the night. I've been in this new work now for a while, and I haven't shown it to anyone, and it would be utterly self-destructive to give it to my editor at this point, but it feels, I don't know, but it might be very, good. So there I was at 3 in the morning or something, wishing very hard for a gentle reader, and I thought of you.
I don't know what to say.
You're flattered.
I'm flattered.
You're intrigued.
I'm intrigued.
And you'll come over now, and I'll show you this damn thing so I can find out if there's anything there.
I can't tonight.
Let him wait. They love to be kept waiting. He
Casey, please.
Now, you're from the Netherlands.
I am.
And is there much of a Dutch film industry? And was there when you started?
Yeah, well, there was. No, when I started, there wasn't anything at all. I mean, there were a couple of movie makers who were quite old and who made documentaries, good documentaries, but not really good features. And then all of a sudden, Paul Verhoeven came along, and he made Turkish Delight and Keetje Tippel and Spetters. And then he asked me to for A Soldier of Orange, which was a big, huge hit. And then he made A Fourth Man with me. And in a period of 10 years' time, Paul was the leading guy in Dutch cinema. And when he left, because when he had such success with all these movies, he was asked by Hollywood. And so he went to Hollywood, and he lives there now, and he's making this new Schwarzenegger movie after RoboCop. And so when Paul left, there were a couple of people still there in Holland who were quite interesting, but I thought that really the heart was sort of out of this body, you know. And I felt quite lost without Paul, because he was my mentor. He was the guy I really looked at and as an absolutely extraordinary movie maker. So, but for an actor, it's always more difficult to go to another country because you have to speak the language. And the director, he could have whatever accent, but for an actor, it's difficult. So finally, after The Fourth Man, they asked me, and I came to the United States, and it's going quite well.
Since there's no film industry, there wasn't film school to go to.
No.
Do you feel that that was an advantage or a disadvantage?
It's a disadvantage, of course. And Paul wasn't really able to work with actors. He knew exactly what movie he wanted to have. He couldn't explain that properly. So what we did is absolutely... Well, to Americans, it's silly. But we were shooting without direct sound. So he was screaming through all the scenes to achieve what he wanted to see. You know, he was screaming like, I don't want to see that. Just go to your right. Do that. Do it again. And that sort of thing. And sometimes when I see Soldier of Orange, when I see it back, I see myself reacting not to my fellow actor, but to the director who was shouting from the other side of the camera. And then I haven't seen Paul. I didn't work with him for a couple of years. And then in The Fourth Man, which was 5 years later, I guess, he had changed completely. And he even he started to rehearse with me first. And we've been talking a lot. But sometimes in the middle of the shoot, he had some of those days that he started to shout again at me. And, well, I was used to it, you know. But that's funny.
So in those early movies, that meant that you had to dub in the sound.
Yeah, we dubbed the whole of Soldier of Orange was dubbed, every line in it. Yeah.
Did you hate doing that?
Oh, yeah. But I'm very good at it, thank God, because I had to do it for weeks on end. And I learned the craft of dubbing there, actually, because we had to do it, all of us. Even me, I remember walking through the sea, and I had this little top, you know, in front of me, and I had to dive into the sea, so I dived several times into this top in front of the microphone, which was quite funny, and running everything we did, everything we dubbed. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you've seen your movies with other actors dubbing in your part, you know, movies that aren't subtitled.
No, I haven't. No. I don't want to, because I know that The Fourth Man is dubbed by someone else. Uh-huh. I did the James Bond German dubbing, I did myself, because I speak German as well. So I went to Munich and did the dubbing there, because I didn't want to give it away to someone else, because I thought, oh, you know, it's not my voice, and it's going to make it duller or at least different from what I should do. And The Fourth Man is dubbed by someone. I always wondered why they didn't ask me to do that, because I could have, of course, an accent in it, because he's a Dutch guy, right?
Uh-huh.
And but they never asked me, and I never want to see it. Some people have it on tape. They said to me, well, you have to see it one day. I said, no, I will not, because I can't stand it. I can't stand it, because I did it. I went through all the emotions, and I went through all the things, and so not another actor could feel whatever I felt there. So maybe he did a good job, I don't know, but I haven't seen it.
Let me ask you, when someone comes up to you in America and recognizes you...
Yeah, which happens a lot here in New York, for instance.
Well, are you not sure whether they're going to recognize you as the villain from the James Bond movie?
No, it's
the
Crossing the
Russian spy scandal, or Crossing the Lancy. So you don't know whether their image of you is going to be as a...
No, because I look very much like the character in Crossing the Lancy. I didn't change my hairdo or my clothes even. I'm even wearing my own jacket. And the other characters, I do look a bit different, you know. That's why you say, oh, I know your face. I've seen you in Crossing the Lancy. Yeah, it's more or less Crossing the Lancy, yeah.
Okay, well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Dutch actor Jeroen Krabbe, he co-stars in the new film Scandal. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up from National Public Radio. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel. More news from China?
For sure. A lot of rumors today, in fact, from China. We'll be hearing from Vicky O'Hara about what's happening at Tiananmen Square. Also, we'll talk with Professor Richard Baum of UCLA, who's just back from China, about what he was hearing. Among the rumors today are a possible list of 100 people who will be arrested, including some important liberal intellectuals in the party. Also that a centrist on the five-man inner Politburo might be about to assume the party leadership. We'll also be hearing about events in Poland where the government, the Communist Party at least, has seen polls which show it's only going to get about 12% of the vote there, and a profile of Argentina's next president.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is Steven Spielberg's third and final film about the archaeologist and adventurer played by Harrison Ford. Guest film critic Owen Gleiberman has a review.
If there's anything trickier to bring off than a sequel, it's the sequel to a sequel. As irresistible as the characters and situations may once have seemed, now they run the risk of flat-out overfamiliarity. Yet in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Steven Spielberg sidesteps the usual third-chapter blues. This new film isn't going to win any prizes for originality. It's really a shameless retread of the original Raiders of the Lost Ark. Once again, Harrison Ford's outrageously intrepid archaeologist, Indiana Jones, is in pursuit of a mystical MacGuffin. Substituting here for the Ark of the Covenant is that larger-than-life icon, the Holy Grail. And once again, Indy's rivals are a crew of leering Nazis who might have stepped freshly minted from some 40s Hollywood thriller. This time around, though, Spielberg bolsters the familiar story with a winning new character, namely Indy's father, Dr. Henry Jones. He's a fuss-budget scholar who's never shared much with his son beyond his love of archaeology, and Sean Connery plays him with impish understatement. It's not quite the robust star turn we expect from Connery, but it'll do. Jones Sr. is searching for the Grail, too, and though Indy himself is more of a chip off the old block than he'd care to admit, relations between the two are anything but smooth.
Dr. Jones.
Yes? Yes?
You have the diary in your pocket.
You don't! Do you think my son would be that stupid that he would bring my diary all the way back here?
You didn't, did you? You didn't bring it, did you?
Well,
You did.
Look, can we discuss this later?
I should have mailed it to the Marx Brothers.
Will you take it easy? Take it easy? Why do you think I sent it home in the first place? So it wouldn't fall into their hands?
I came here to save you.
Oh, yeah? And who's going to come to save you, Junior?
Connery is a little miffed right there, but for most of the movie, he spits out the word Junior with maximum wry finesse, affectionately putting Indy in his place. It's no wonder Spielberg plays down the love angle this time. Despite a few obligatory meetings between Indy and a beautiful blonde Austrian with a shady secret, the true romance in The Last Crusade is the one between Indy and his lovable, infuriating dad. Connery has been having a field day recently playing Zen father figures, and he helps humanize Harrison Ford's bravado. Playing off Connery, Ford finds a new urgency in the character. There hasn't been an action hero this soulful since, well, since Sean Connery handed the role of James Bond over to lesser mortals. True, the banter between Ford and Connery is a bit on the functional side. It lacks the requisite screwball comedy sparkle. Yet the relationship has just enough heart to speak to those of us who feel that the Raiders movies, for all their insolent showmanship, have represented Spielberg at his most mechanical and confining. Indeed, Spielberg and producer George Lucas are right to make this the final installment in the series. As an action fantasy, The Last Crusade is exciting without being exhilarating. The movie lacks the slapstick audacity of Raiders, or the near-demonic relentlessness of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Spielberg took an unfair lambasting over that last film, and it's clear that on some level, he's desperately trying to atone for the critical attacks he received. With The Last Crusade, he's made a first-rate, if unimaginative, PG adventure movie. And now, it's time to get off the roller coaster.
Owen Gleiberman is a freelance writer and former film editor of the Boston Phoenix. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. As an architect and writer, Witold Rybczynski had designed houses and written about them, but he grew frustrated that he'd never actually built one himself. Next time, Rybczynski talks about building his home and moving in. It's the subject of his new book, The Most Beautiful House in the World. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone reviews World Without End, the latest show by New York performance artist Holly Hughes. And pianist Harry Connick Jr. returns to our weekly performance spot. So I hope you could join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Laura Civitz. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burden directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.